This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of A Stab in the Dark, the UK TV podcast that investigates the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama, that drags them kicking and screaming into a badly lit and overheated interview room and grills them like bacon rashers in strict contravention of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. My name's Mark Billingham, and today we're back on the road, this time in the BBC's swanky media city in Salford, where I'm very pleased to say that I'm joined by two of the most respected talents in British TV crime drama, award-winning screenwriter Danny Brocklehurst and one of the most recognisable actresses on our TV screens, Mianna Buring. We'll be chatting with Danny and Mianna about their careers, about secrets and lies, about corsets and fake baby bumps, and we'll be talking about their brand new crime drama on BBC One, In the Dark, which I have nothing to do with at all. No siree, nothing whatsoever. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark. So, Danny, Mianna, welcome. Thank you very much for coming. And
Hello.
And we're filming this in the middle of summer, and it is a hot one here in Manchester today. So with that in mind, before we get to the serious stuff, very important question. What's your ice cream of choice, Danny?
Oh, I didn't know you were going to start that way.
Oh, yeah? Going to throw the hard ones at you first.
I'd probably rum and raisin, something like that.
But, I mean, like a lolly? A lolly of choice?
A lolly of choice?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a Mivvy, a Zoom.
Something that's got a sort of, maybe a bit of ice cream in the middle. What do you think about that?
Those twisty ones, what are they called?
Yeah, they're quite good.
Yeah, like they're like twisty.
What are they called? The twisters.
Yay, that's the
one. One of the ones that I've got like bubble gum in. Do you remember those from when you were a kid?
No, not having that.
But rum and raisin would be your flavour. Your flavour of choice?
Chocolate.
Yeah. Okie dokie. All right, well, I'm going to throw pistachio into the mix just to be controversial. Now, just to set the scene, we are here at Media City to promote the show In the Dark. We've got a screening to attend, Q&As to circumnavigate, and then hopefully a lot of drinks to drink. So I want to talk about In the Dark later on. But before that, I want to talk to both of you a bit about your amazing careers, because incredibly varied, and you're both incredibly prolific. Do you both have very strong work ethics? Mianna, you got a strong work ethic?
Actually, I think so. Yeah, I think. I've always kind of said it, and I still feel it. I think graft is really important. I think it's, and it's probably as I've got older, I've realised that was instilled in me quite early on. And I didn't think of it as a strong work ethic. I just thought that's what you did. But now I think more and more I realise that, I'm quite happy to work, roll up my sleeves. And I'm never, even if it's not acting, I'm never not doing something.
Right.
Actually, that's not true. I work and work and work, and then I end up having a complete collapse for like 3 days.
Then just nothing.
Then I do nothing. But then literally, like, I'm comatose. I do not move. I don't, you know, I sort of have everything around me that I need and sort of reachable distance, and I don't move for 3 days.
Okay, so lots of cushions, TV, remote control.
Absolutely, exactly.
Kind of
food, the whole lot, yeah.
Okay, Danny, what about you? You're a grafter. You're a grafter.
You are.
Yeah, I think you've got to be as a writer. Otherwise, if you don't kind of set yourself down every day and try and write, then you're just going to start to muck around and, you know, like now at this time of year, watch the tennis or, you know, go for a bath or sort of, you know, have a nice bit of lunch, you know. So unless you kind of, you know, unless you really think, oh God, I've got to do, you know, I've got to hit so many pages a day or whatever, you know, I do like a deadline. The panic of a deadline is very helpful.
But then there is this ludicrous idea that people have about writers that it isn't quite a job. That we all swan about waiting for the muse to descend and these ideas to come on fairy dust. But it is just about putting your ass in the chair and going to work, isn't it?
I think it is, really, yeah. I think it is. And I think you can, I think I have encountered writers who do that thing. Oh, well, I'm not, you know, I'm just waiting for the right moment. You think, well, you good luck with that. You know, I mean, it's not a regular job in that, you know, you don't have to work office hours. I mean, I do tend to keep reasonably sensible hours, but you know, there are some nights where you're still working at, you know, all kinds of hours to get things done and you know, having to do, you know, do things that are kind of like out of the norm, and yeah. I think that's just part and parcel of the business, and you've got to accept that. And then other days I will just, you know, bunk off halfway through the day and go and do something pleasant.
There has to be this kind of, you know, there has to be discipline. There does have to be discipline. It's not not airy-fairy and arty-farty, is it? You've got to get things done and move things
certainly
along.
Not television writing. I think novel writing is more like that.
Is it?
I believe so, yeah.
Okie dokie. Yeah, no, I do. I sit about all day in a sort of silk dressing gown like Noel Coward and dictate my novels to a small team of elves.
Do not burst this bubble for me, because that's how I believe you write.
Oh, is it? Okay. Hold on to that.
Okay,
hold on
yes,
to that.
Good.
Now, Danny, there's a very, we're here in Manchester, very strong sense of Manchester in your work. So let's talk a bit about the city. What's special about this place? I mean, I know it's your part of the world, but why is it so great to write about?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I suppose for me, it's home and always kind of, you know, always has been. I've always lived here. So, you know, you kind of, that kind of seeps into you. Especially as a sort of proud Mancunian. And I think I naturally kind of, when I think up a new idea, I naturally think, well, it'll be set in Manchester then, you know, until otherwise somebody tells me, you know, well, like the next thing I'm doing is set in Northern Ireland. But not for any reason other than we did it through BBC Northern Ireland and we thought it might be good to do a family drama set there, you know. But it could, in my mind, when I started it, it was set in Manchester. You know?
Even if there are scenes that take place on beaches and things, you're like, yeah, Manchester, that's the place.
But I think it depends what you're doing. I mean, if you're doing a show like In the Dark, or if you're doing a show like The Driver that I did a couple of years ago, then there's something very useful about a city like Manchester, because it's a good enough size to be a proper major city with major things going on. But it's not kind of, you know, it's not unwieldy like London. So you can use the centre, and you can have people sort of bumping into each other in a sort of reasonably credible way.
And as we discovered making In the Dark, which we'll talk about later, you don't have to go too far out of Manchester, get into areas that are a lot more rural. And you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
Your sort of big break, I suppose, came about via Paul Abbott. Tell us a little bit about how that happened. And I presume you're a fan of his work already.
Yeah, I was. I was a massive fan of his work and Jimmy McGovern. But yeah, I was very fortunate, really. I mean, I was trying to break into the industry. I'd written for theatre and for radio at this point, and I was trying to break into television. And I was working as a journalist for a magazine called City Life. It's like Time Out. And they said, oh, do you want to go and interview Paul Abbott? I was like, yeah, of course I do. So I went to his house, and Paul is quite a sort of, you know, we were talking earlier about writers who like to be distracted. So Paul was very happy to be distracted by this interview. And then once we'd done the interview, then he's getting the wine out. And one thing, you know, the conversation flows on. And I thought, oh, sod it. I'm going to say, hey, I'm a writer, you know. So, so I forced him into reading a script. And luckily, I don't know what he thought of it, but luckily he passed it on to Nicola Schindler at Red Productions, and they liked it enough to invite me to pitch for a show they were doing at the time called Clocking Off. Yeah. And I got the job, and that was the break. And so, yeah, I owe both of them an enormous...
So if Paul Abbott hadn't got the wine out, it might never have happened. Yeah, you'd have just done the interview and toddled off home again.
Well, that's what would normally happen, but luckily Paul likes to drink, so it was happy days.
And then you end up working on Shameless. What was that like?
Yeah, well, we did three shows together, me and Paul, but Shameless was incredible because it was obviously at the time a massive, you know, those first two or three series were massive. And I don't know if I'll ever work on a show like that again, really. It just really hit something. It hit a nerve in with the public. And it was a huge hit. We won all kinds of awards. You know, it was a real roller coaster ride. I mean, it was a very difficult show to make because you always felt you had to top what you'd just done. And that gets harder and harder when you're dealing with the Gallaghers. But
And you're not talking about Noel and Liam.
No. So yeah, it was a brilliant show, but it was a very, very hard show, particularly once we got to series three, because you know we'd already thrown a lot of stuff at it. I mean, obviously it ran for years and years and years, but I personally felt it declined in the end in its quality.
Yeah, what should have stopped earlier?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really hard to keep things going. I mean, I think you can do it for a few years, but then, you know, tell me the show that's still amazing on series eight. You know?
Well, it's a very tricky thing. There are plenty of writers of series novels who go through exactly that thing when you kind of go, it might be time to stop, but they get persuaded to... not including himself. You know, get
on. Who are these people?
Right, well, you know, plenty of novelists write two or three books too many.
Yeah.
You know, and you like to be you'd like to think you'll know when it's time to stop, but you know, and there's a successful show. And anyway, so Mianna, you've been involved in some, you know, huge movies and TV shows, franchises, pretty much. Did you have a break, a big break along the kind of lines that Danny was talking about, and did it involve wine?
I'm sure wine was involved, yes. I kind of did. I think for me it was two things in conjunction. One was Ben Wheatley, who I had done a sort of TV, BBC weird thing with CGI, a kind of sketch show with CGI that I'd auditioned for and met him and done, along with Neil Maskell and Michael Smiley and Emma Fryer, I think, was in that as well. And then years later, he called us all up and said, come and read the script. And we realised quickly that he'd written all the parts in the script for us, and that script was Kill List. So we did this quirky, weird, dark little film.
Fantastic film. If anybody's listening and has not seen Kill List, you need to see Kill List.
Which kind of blew all of our minds while we were doing it. But, you know, again, you never know that anything's going to be received in the way Kill List was. You know, you can't anticipate that. And so that came out at the same time. While we were filming it, I had put myself on tape randomly for one of the new parts in the latest Twilight films that were coming out, thinking, I'm never going to be seen. Like, I'm nobody from England and, you know, who's this kid? Well, not kid, I was in my 30s at the time. And 2 weeks later, I got a call saying, you've got the part. I did an audition, I sent in a tape.
I'm always interested in that. Yeah. You read about this, actors putting themselves on tape. How does that physically work? You set a camera up and you...
Yep, I set a camera up. I had my mate Daniel was in town. I said, Daniel, can you come and help me? I was had a little studio in Southwark at the time that I just moved into. And we sort of set up a camera and filmed it, and I sent it off. And 2 weeks later, I had to pack up the little studio because I realised I'd be gone for like 8 months. So,
wow.
Yeah. So it was, but those films came out at the same time. So one was this massive sort of, you know, teenage YA franchise, which had this huge following. And the other was this, off the beaten track, imaginative, brilliant sort of indie film. And because they came out at the same time, it was harder to pigeonhole me, but it meant that I think I got into rooms because of that I'd never been in before. And people didn't quite know where to place me. So had it just been Twilight, I'm sure I would have gone up for maybe more, you know, sort of Twilighty stuff, or
with vampires and werewolves.
Yeah, that's the way it often works. And had it just been Kill List, I think I would have just gone up for, you know, more maybe horror stuff. But because they both came out, I think it meant that, you know, all of a sudden I'd been in a big franchise film, tick. That's always good for investors. And I'd also done this quirky indie film that, you know, was kind of critically recognised.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, she can maybe act as well, maybe. So, and I think, so yeah, that for me was what I feel changed everything. And I'm hugely grateful.
I want to talk to you in a minute about two rather enormous TV shows that you've been in. But before, I need to throw a quote at Danny. Mm. Oh, yeah. Now, there's a lot of research goes into this. I'm going to throw some... Now, a couple of years ago in the Radio Times, you said that you weren't very interested in period dramas and historical dramas. Do you still stand by that, Mr. Brocklehurst?
I'm nervous about where unless this is going.
Unless they're set in Manchester, obviously, and then you'll be snapping them up. No, not a fan.
Well, I think I just want to sort of be clear on what I meant in
Your Honour.
Don't cut yourself out of work now.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of things that are set in like the kind of proper period drama. So you're having to kind of get the bonnets and get dressed up, and it's like, you know, it's all a long time ago. I know they're very popular, but it's just not for me, and I've got no real interest in writing that stuff.
But is that, but okay? But you'd write something, say, in the 60s.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
it's the crinoline, isn't it? It's the top hats. You can't be doing.
You know what? I would even write something a long time in the past. I've just got to feel that there's a connection to, that there's a contemporary sort of nature to it. So if it was something that was set way in the past but had a real contemporary resonance, I could probably get together with it. But I think what starts to happen is I can't connect with those dramas, and I just start to see famous actors in funny costumes speaking in
dressing up.
Yeah, exactly.
But obviously, I'm raising this issue because, Mianna, you've been involved in two enormously successful period dramas, Downton Abbey and Ripper Street. Very different.
I apologise.
Very different dramas. No. I don't want to drive a wedge between the two of you. That's not what I'm
fisticuffs.
Here for.
Fisticuffs. No.
I've got more time for one of those than the other. Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We won't go any further than that. But Downton Abbey was enormous. Clearly enormous. So how is it playing a character like Edna Braithwaite, knowing that there's 10 million, 11 million people hanging on you every word every Sunday night?
I think I was really naive. I didn't even think that was the case. I think I've always seen this might sound a bit weird. When I was doing it, I saw myself as being very much a guest actor and a guest part character that was coming in to sort of fill in a little slot for a while. And so I didn't feel any pressure. I felt like a kid in a candy shop. You know, I got to go get on the set and, you know, hang out with these actors that I really admired, and you know, and I loved it, and I felt no pressure whatsoever. And I feel actually, in a way, I mean, I know I got a bit of flack that I noticed in terms of, I'd get sort of tweets and people saying, you know, I hate Mianna Buring. She's so evil. And I'd be like, hang on a second, you know.
She's so evil.
You don't know Mianna Buring. You're talking about Edna Braithwaite in Downton Abbey, which is a character. You know, if you take it up with the writers, always, you know, but so stuff like that would happen. But that doesn't bother me.
But did it change? I mean, did the atmosphere on set change as it became very obvious this thing was like a runaway, you know, runaway machine?
I think because I came in the third season, and by then it had already picked up. So I think everybody who was there and established knew that it was a major thing. And I think their lives had changed. They were starting to notice the change. And I think season three, season four, because obviously, they were flying out to America and doing all the American shows. And that's quite a major thing. You know, you feel like there's a difference in your career. And again, it's a thing where you end up in rooms that you wouldn't have got into before. And I sort of feel like I was on the periphery of that. So I got to really enjoy it and enjoy lots of perks because of it. But I wasn't in that kind of central frenzy of it, I feel.
And so aside from having to explain the very concept of fiction to people on Twitter, were you sad to leave the show?
Well, again, I always thought that I sort of knew, because I was doing Ripper Street, so I was contracted to Ripper Street. So I was going to come in for a Christmas special, that was it. And then I got a call saying, would I come back? And I said yes, but I couldn't come back permanently because I was doing Ripper Street. So very sweetly, Julian Fellowes agreed that he'd write my character back in for three or four episodes. So I thought that was incredibly generous. So it meant that, you know, I got to do this one off and then kind of come back. And by that point, it felt like a family and a set that I knew and a character that I got to sort of explore a bit more. And I think it's always great to play because, you know, no one's out and out evil. That just, I don't think that is very rare in life and also in fiction. But I think somebody who commits acts or behaves in a way that's, you know, morally questionable, I think it's so interesting to play.
Well,
you know, there's
that.
Always an excuse for why they might do it, but it's just much more interesting to delve into that than to, you know, be the sugary.
Well, it's
sugary
the perfect point to talk about Long Susan then in Ripper Street, a very ambiguous character, shall we say. Where do you think she was by the end? I mean,
You see, because for me, again, you know, playing a character, you always defend your character. So for me, I feel that, I mean, my heart broke for her at the end because I feel that she was always remorseful. She never set out to hurt people who didn't deserve to be hurt. She set out to take over an empire in a man's world, and she set out to hurt her father, who was an incredibly cruel man. She never set out to kill innocent people. That was never her intention. But then, of course, that's ultimately what happened. She was responsible for the death of lots of people, and I think she was very remorseful. But I think because her intentions were good, I think it was easier for her to sort of protect her family and her child, and for that to be her motivation, as opposed to saying yes, take me to prison and kill me immediately. That wouldn't, she felt that she could maybe not be forgiven, but definitely she felt that she had a reason to fight for her son and her family.
Well, so both, both very interesting roles to play, obviously, and both shows that were dealing with, with the class, that had political elements, and were both set in different periods when women's roles in society were changing. So back to you, Mr. Brocklehurst, has your opinion of period drama changed at all in the last 5 minutes?
Let's do period drama.
Yes.
You are so entitled to that opinion.
You are. Now, look, we will be talking a lot more to Danny and Mianna more after the break. But before then, it's that time in the show when our roving reporter goes out and about to bring you more of the best crime fiction and TV crime dramas. So with that, it's over to our man with the spyglass, Paul Hirons. What have you got for us, Paul?
Yes, thanks, Mark. Now, seeing as you've been talking to Danny and Mianna about ice creams, it's put me in a bit of a summery mood. So I thought I'd don my metaphorical budgie smugglers, order a cheap pina colada, and slather myself in Factor 30. Yes, it's that time of the year when people are looking to take something away with them on holiday to read by the pool or on the beach. Now, in the crime genre, there have already been dozens of fantastic books released this year that would easily qualify for a good summer read. And I'm taking it that you've already read some of our guests like Ian Rankin, Belinda Bauer, Sarah Hillary, Sarah Pinborough, Bill Beverley, Megan Abbott and Laura Lippman's latest. But we wanted to give you some ideas of other books to take away with you on holiday. So me and Joel are here in our decidedly unsummery studio. Give us a wave, Joel. Ready to run down A Stab in the Dark's top summer reads. Joel, hit the music. So, in no particular order, let's start with The Dry by Jane Harper. It starts when Luke Hadler turns a gun on his wife and child, and then himself, in a small Australian town called Kiwara. When federal police investigator Aaron Falk returns for the funerals, he's not that keen to get involved, but sure enough, he gets dragged into the investigation to the point where he begins to doubt Luke Hadler's murder-suicide charge. And as Falk probes deeper into the killings, old wounds start bleeding into fresh ones and long-buried secrets begin to bubble up to the surface. Next in our top summer reads is The Marsh King's Daughter by Karen Dion. When the notorious child abductor known as the Marsh King escapes from a maximum security prison, Helena immediately suspects that she and her two young daughters are in danger. And no one, not even her husband, knows the truth about Helena's past. They don't know that she was born into captivity, that she had no contact with the outside world before the age of 12, or that her father raised her to be a killer. Next, we have friend of A Stab in the Dark, Mel McGrath, who's back with psychological thriller Give Me the Child. Dr. Kat Lupo aches for another child despite the psychosis which marked her first pregnancy. So when Ruby Winter, a small girl in need of help, arrives in the middle of the night, it seems like fate. But as the events behind Ruby's arrival emerge, her mother's death, her connection to Kat, Kat questions whether her decision to help Ruby has put her own daughter at risk. And when she starts to research Ruby, she can't believe what she's found. Next up is Fierce Kingdom by Jin Phillips. So this is an incredibly nervy book and takes place in real time between 4:55 and 8:05 p.m. on one day when Mum Joan and her young son are just leaving the zoo. When they hear popping sounds, she soon discovers that they aren't balloons, but gunshots. That 4 hours sees Joan do everything she can to protect her son from the bad guys inside the zoo. Our final book of our summer read selection is Lie With Me by Sabine Durant. Even though it was released last year, it's still perfect for taking away with you on your summer jolts. And some would say it's still the perfect holiday read because, well, it takes place on a holiday. It tells the story of Paul, a failed novelist and now freeloader, who's invited by an old university friend to go on holiday to Greece with them and some other families. And that's when the fun really begins. You won't want to accept a free holiday to Greece again. Well, you probably will, let's face it. And that's it. I could have mentioned Matt Veselowski's Six Stories, or Steph Broadrib's Deep Down Dead, or Peter James's new Roy Grace novel, Need You Dead, or if you like your Nordic noir, Arnaldur Indridason's The Shadow District, or Joe Nesbo's The Thirst, but I'll leave it there. So while I go and get a Solera and try to get a good spot by the pool, it's back to you, Mark, in the studio.
Thanks, Paul. Well, we're back now with our special guests, Danny Brocklehurst and Mianna Brewering, and we will be talking quite a lot about BBC One's forthcoming drama In the Dark, which Danny has adapted from books by some crime writer or other, and in which Mianna stars as lead character Helen Week. Just before we do that, I'm going to throw another quote at you now, Danny, which I found very interesting. You said, and this is 12 years ago, so you did say, in our world weary times, television has lost the power to shock.
You were talking about some of your heroes, like Dennis Potter
and stuff. Where do you think we are now with TV drama? I mean, do you think, has it upped its game when it comes to being, you know, a thought-provoking genre, a shocking genre? Are there any real auteurs left? Where are we? Where are we now? State of the Nation address, Danny.
Gosh. Yeah, I think things have changed a lot since was that a piece I wrote for The Guardian or something? I seem to remember it was around the Shameless time, wasn't it? I can't remember. Yeah, I think television is really moved on. I mean, in the last 10 years, you know, the way that television has changed and become the kind of the medium of choice for people who actually want to author work now, you know, much more than film, I would argue at the moment. And particularly some of the things that are happening, you know, in American cable TV and obviously over here as well. It's incredible what you can attempt now and what you can try and, you know, put onto TV screens. I mean, yeah, I don't know where to start really with that discussion.
A big answer, but no, I think we are in a very interesting place. Obviously you've done loads of original drama. What's it like to sit down and adapt work? What's the key difference? I mean, apart from the obvious one, that, you know, you start with a novel or whatever. Do you just get out that big red pen? Is that the first thing? I'm going to get my nice new red pen and just put lines through all the stuff I don't need.
Yeah, you do that, definitely. Try and work out where the plot holes are, you know.
Oh, that hurts.
You know, I mean, I think on one level it's easier because you've obviously got the story there and the characters, and you know, you when you're doing an original piece, you've always got the sort of, you know, the gaping sort of blank sheet of paper that you've got to fill. And even if you've written episode one, you've still got a number of episodes and you think, how are we going to end this thing? And, you know, that can be very stressful. Whereas at least when you're adapting a novel, you've got a framework. Even if you're going to change things, you know, you've got a framework. And what I usually do is either myself or usually get somebody else to do it is... you do a chapter breakdown, so you've got a kind of, you know, a sort of map of the novel, if you like. And then you try and work out how that's going to fit together as a TV piece. And then, you know, that's just about me trying to use my television skills to work out how this story is going to work in however many hours we're telling it over and what we need to exclude, change, keep, you know, enhance, whatever.
But what's interesting to me is that there are, I do know writers who have been involved in that. The originators of the material, yeah. I mean, and I think that's a massive mistake. I think that process that you're talking about, I don't think the writer of the novel can have any part in that. I think it would be a massive mistake. Do you not think? I mean, you're too close to it. You can't, you know, you can't lose that. Oh, no, you can't lose it. You've got to let someone who's removed from it and who also has done it before and knows what they're doing to do that stuff.
I think so. I think it's difficult. And I think the thing about being too close to it is definitely something that needs to be taken into consideration. You know, you've spent a lot of time writing that story once as a novel. And I think to then go through and try and do it again, you know, somehow objectively to turn it into into a different medium, I think is a very tricky task.
Would it be off-putting for you if somebody came to you and said, we want you to adapt this, it's a great novel, we want you to adapt it, the writer of the novel wants to be really, really involved. Would that kind of sound alarm bells for you a bit?
I think you'd have to define what that meant, really.
Sitting behind you while you're looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, it might ring a few alarm bells. I mean, I don't know. You know, I think I might have said this to you when we started out on this process, but you know, this is what stays with me about adaptation. And I think I'm correctly attributing this to Simon Beaufoy, who, when he was adapting, I think it was it called Q&A, the novel that turned out to be Slumdog Millionaire,
right?
Whatever it was called, anyway. He sat down with the author of that book and said, "All I can promise is that I will keep the spirit
Absolutely.
Of your book."
Yeah.
And he made a lot of changes, and it became, you know, obviously this massive film, but he kept absolutely the spirit of that original novel.
Yeah. No, and that is the important thing. I mean, we, you know, we did work reasonably closely on it. You would send me scripts, I would feed stuff back. You, I mean, there wasn't a lot of ego flying about, which I think was a very, very good thing on either side. But there were times when I would see a script, and there's one, without giving anything away, one very major change in terms of a character's father, of Helen's father. It's not giving anything away. But I remember turning the page and reading that and going, "Whoa, Danny!" And then just and but. It works. I mean, you just go, you know, I think with all these things, when you get emails or whatever from people going, why did that change to that? And why? And you go, because there wasn't a good reason why not. You know, I mean, if it works, it works. And it's a different thing. And I think often people who've read the books and then see the TV things don't make that leap. You know, it's almost like they're sitting there watching with the book in front of them, going, "Oh, it's changed now." Yeah. It doesn't say that, which is what I find very.
If anybody
very
does
odd.
That on this project, they'll be in for quite a few shocks.
They're in for a lot of shocks. Now we're going to talk about Helen Weeks, obviously, Mianna, and there's a lot of female detectives on TV at the moment, major female characters.
Yeah. What
were your first impressions of Helen when you first read the script? Because obviously you read Danny's script before you went back to the books.
Yes, I did. Right. Yeah, I did.
And you did that in the wrong order.
I know, right? That's where I went wrong. That's why. I did because I thought that was sort of the Bible that I would be working off initially. You know, those were the lines that I'd be speaking. Those were the situations I'd be in. So I always think whenever I do anything, I always use the script that I have as the springboard. But it's always a joy to have the possibility to go and do further research, because normally you have the script and that gives you all the information, and then any holes that you need filled in, you just have your own imagination to do that with, or research or whatever. But this time there were your novels as well, which was great, because obviously then you get with novels you have a kind of running monologue that's quite useful, that kind of gives you a sense of how they think and how they speak, and then you try and merge that with what's on, you know, what's in the script.
But she does follow, I mean, she's very similar in a lot of ways to the characters you're describing before. There are a lot of secrets, there are a lot of ambiguities about the character. I guess it's an obvious question, but those are the characters that actors are always attracted to, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Come on. You want a bit, you know, you want to play with levels, and you want to have skeletons in the closet.
And crucially pregnant. Crucially, she is
pregnant.
A bit pregnant.
Yes.
Now we see the full. We see the full pregnancy in episodes 3 and 4. But what are the physical challenges of playing a woman who's heavily pregnant? I mean, you know, obviously there's the prosthetic sort of baby bump and stuff. But there's more than that going on, right?
Well, it's just to kind of make it feel believable that she's pregnant. You know, because you know, having just the image of a pregnant woman, I think, creates a vulnerability for the viewer, which I think is quite interesting. But in playing that, you just want to make sure that you're not, you know, it's just making, you know, with Helen, it was making choices that would mean she wasn't a woman who during pregnancy couldn't move. She could move. She could, you know, she wasn't bedridden. She could move. She wasn't, even at 8 months, she was quite agile, really. And she needed to be that in order to do all the things she needs to do in the script. But then it was finding how to do that so it kind of looked believable. you know, there'd be some scenes where I'd go, oh no, I'm, you know, I moved like a non-pregnant woman there. I need to, let's go back. Let me just waddle a little bit more. Or, you know, I remember like the bath scene, like slipping in the bath. I had a friend of mine came round and I said, show me how as a pregnant woman you would slip in a, you know, or like you might get in and out of a bath rather. And
whoa, I got to stop you here. You asked, I presume, a pregnant friend.
Yes, well, a friend who had been pregnant several
said,
times.
Can you come over and get in the bath for me?
Yes, yes. I mean, she was fully clothed. There was no water in the bath, but yes.
Oh, I see.
I needed to be able to see her get in and out of the bath just to make that sort of believable. Yeah.
Okay.
So I did stuff like that, and I got pregnant friends to stand up and sit down for me so I could watch how they stood up and like watch their center of gravity. And then I just, like I've said this, but I just cherry picked what would work for Helen, would be right for the script, and then ran
there
with
are
that.
Still people who treat pregnant women like they're ill.
Yeah, and
you
they're
know,
not.
And then you get Serena Williams coming along and winning a grand slam while she's pregnant.
Absolutely. You know, and there's some women who are ill, and you know, I personally couldn't do what Helen could do, like in the first 3 months at all. I was bedridden, but Helen wasn't, and it's true that, you know, she's not ill. She's strong and she's feisty just as much as she was before she was pregnant. But I do think that visual is really strong. There's something, even, you know, playing her, I felt very protective of her as her bump grew.
Well, now that you've mentioned your own.
Yes, I have. Sorry,
your own pregnancy. Yeah. No, but we can now at least let listeners know that the little squeaks and moans you're hearing are not me or Danny.
they're not me.
There's a small baby in very like as opposed to a massive baby. There's a very tiny baby in the room. It strikes me that the renaissance of the sort of whole female led detective show was probably kickstarted by Scandinoirs like The Killing and The Bridge. Now, as someone born in Sweden, are you surprised that the Brits have taken Scandinavian based drama so much to our hearts? And that's in novels as well as on TV.
No, I'm not surprised, but partly because I think Brits have always been culturally fascinated by the sort of thriller and detective stories that's existed long before these particular Scandi stories came along. And as have Scandinavians, they have a long history of long love affair with that genre too. But these particular stories that came out, The Killing and The Bridge, they are brilliant. They are fantastic. And I think a good story translates. You will want to watch it, and I think we have a very because of Britain's sort of long history of great television. I think we have a very discerning audience. They're sophisticated. They like great storytelling, and when it's out there, it doesn't matter if it's subtitled. And I think that's what was interesting, and the difference this time was that audiences were willing to watch a great story despite having to read subtitles.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that fascination you talked about is there with the landscape as much as anything, because to people in this country, it's such an odd landscape. To people who take their holidays in Spain and France or whatever, Scandinavian landscapes are kind of strange. And let's be honest, blood looks pretty good against snow. But it's obviously more than that. It's the characters. I mean, Sarah Lund and Sagan are great, strong characters. And long-form drama. You know?
Absolutely. And I think that's what was interesting with In the Dark for me as well, was that I felt that, like in those stories, every character that's introduced to you has a background, they have a history, you can feel it, you can taste it. They're not just, you know, they're not just kind of stocking fillers to propel a bit of plot line. They've got meat to their bones, even if they have, you know, three lines. And I think you know, for me, that's a test of you know, great script and great storytelling. That is the truth, and I think that they had that, and I feel that In the Dark has that too, and that's what I loved when I read it and got involved. And obviously, it does in a way have a history because of the books. These aren't characters that just sprung out of, you know, a couple of weeks ago. They've been around for years, and I think they've marinated, you know.
Marinated and rotted.
Yeah.
But new life, I think, has been breathed into British crime drama. Obviously, Danny, you write a lot of other things aside from genre stuff, from crime, like crime drama, like In the Dark. But it has become hugely successful, obviously, with two episodes, probably by the time this goes out, into In the Dark. And I hope it's massively successful. Obviously, we all do. But when something becomes successful like British crime drama, do you think there can be too much of it? I mean, it does seem to be everywhere. And the same is true with books and with movies. And
of course.
Does it get on your wick?
There, of course, can be too much of it. And I think that is the sort of easy criticism that does get levelled at new shows, you know, when they come out and, you know, the critics are like, oh, here's another, you know.
Oh, here's another Maverick cop.
Here's another Maverick cop, here's another, you
but
know.
What do you want? And not... Not Maverick cop?
So I don't think Helen is a maverick. Not in that sense. She's not like, I'm going to do this, whatever you say. You know, she doesn't have... There are secrets. There are certainly secrets. But it's not like, you know, she's drinking heavily and listening to particularly quirky music or any of that stuff.
We missed a trick there, guys.
Yeah, I know. What quirky music would we... Maybe she's a secret Morris dancer.
Absolutely like. She is.
That would have been good to do, wouldn't it? Can't Morris dance pregnant?
Yes.
Can you?
Of course you can,
I'm sure you'd have carried it off.
Helen could have.
She could have. Now, one of the criticisms that's often levelled at some TV crime drama is the degree of what's often seen as gratuitous violence. Do you think that's fair? And where do you both come at that from, both as a writer and an actor? Danny first.
Well, I think that's a fair criticism because I think sometimes the violence as portrayed can be over the top, but you know, I think as a program maker, you've got to try and assess where you need to use extreme violence and where other things can be suggested. You know, I'm a big fan of the suggestion and the audience filling
more.
In the gap. Yeah, less is more, absolutely. But you know, there are times when you do need to show some things. I mean, without giving anything away, there is a scene. And in the second story of In the Dark, which is, you know, it's quite rough. But, you know, I think you've just got to pick and choose. You've got to kind of choose your moment of when to shock an audience and when to hold back, I think.
And is that something that you are looking at very much when you're reading scripts? If you do perceive something as being gratuitous and violent, will you speak up? Will you not do it? Will you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I always feel my mind. Yeah,
really?
I don't hold back. I do. I think, and I completely agree with you, Danny, that it's sort of, suggestion is very powerful. And every now and again, I watch things and I just feel like it's somebody who's grown up in a very safe environment who has no real understanding of what the consequences of violence actually are. You have to have respect for that because, you know, if you're telling a story about real violence and face it, you are in these, you know, detective stories. We're not, you know, it's not like somebody stole my teddy bear.
Right.
That's not the story. But you know, violence is a horrendous thing, and I think you have to have respect for it.
But that's what you've got to show, rather than
it's
not necessarily the violence itself. It's not about showing what violence looks like, but about what violence feels like. You know what it does
absolutely,
to those characters.
Yeah, that's well put, actually.
So what's next for you both? Obviously, In the Dark is big in all our lives at the minute. But what's next for you both, Danny?
Well, I'm doing another show for BBC, which is called Come Home. Which hasn't got a dead body in it.
No.
There's no police in it.
Not even one.
No, nothing. No, I know.
Should we just walk on sort of police parts in the background?
Yeah,
that'd be fine, right? That won't.
Nobody commits any kind of crime of any. No, overdue
no.
Library books. Nothing.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be really dramatic. Huh?
Crazy man.
Yeah. No, it is. It's about a family. It's about a mother who walks out on her kids, and it's about the consequences of that on a family. And it's very, very emotional. And you know, the BBC sort of gave us I pitched the idea, and the BBC kind of gave us the challenge, which is fantastic of just making it as emotional and characterful as we could. Because I think, you know, to go back to your earlier point, I think they feel that's brilliant as crime drama is, and certainly it pulls the ratings, you know, often. They need to sort of shake up their schedules and offer different things and different tones and different moods, you know, which is fair enough.
And what about you, Mianna? Obviously, there's a small person to take into consideration.
To keep alive, yeah.
Yeah, but have you got something on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm maybe going to Norway to do a 10-parter with a director-writer who's become a friend as well. And I think that's part of the sort of draw, is that I really love the group of people who are doing it, and it's for me, they feel like quite a family sort of atmosphere. And yeah, we'll see. I wasn't expected to maybe go back to work that soon, but I sort of, yeah, again, I think it's part of that graft. And being a freelancer, you're not used to saying no.
Oh, it's hard, isn't
it? We've got to learn. But I think it'll be fun. It'll be an adventure.
Well, now, as promised in each episode, we ask our guests to come along with their recommendations for a good read and a good watch. Let's start with you, Danny. What have you read recently that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
You could have told me you were going to ask me that. I could have thought about it.
Well, it's easy to put you on the spot. Then it just becomes a sort of, yeah, that. I must recommend that. It's a gut reaction. Doesn't have to be recently. Just a book you'd like to recommend.
Well, you know what? I've just read the Phil Spector biography, which I thought was unbelievable. It was an astonishingly good read. I mean, you know, the guy who invented the wall of sound, then produced the Beatles, and then obviously killed someone in his own home. And, you know, it was kind of...
Have you seen that bizarre movie with Al Pacino?
I haven't seen it, but it made me want to watch it.
Strangest wigs you've ever seen playing. It's absolutely bonkers. But
yeah, and it's an astonishing story. I mean, you know, and the court case is astonishing, and yeah, it's a really good biography.
Okay, what about something to watch?
The Leftovers. Big fan of The Leftovers. Nobody really watches it. It's made for HBO. I think the show on Sky over here, and I just think it's astonishing. I mean, it's quite high concept, but yeah, it's storytelling unlike anything else.
Okay, Leftovers. Now, Mianna, what about something to read that you'd like to recommend?
So I recently finished Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, which I thought was incredible and should just be it's a compulsory read in every classroom. And then watching-wise, I have just finished the entire series of Breaking Bad.
Oh, right.
Right the way through. So I'd sort of watched the first two series and then kind of forgot about it years ago and then came back to it, and it's great.
It is, isn't it?
It's really good, and it's for storytelling and breaking down storytelling. It's just... Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. I love it. I am the one who knocks. Yeah, Oh, and I just hate him so much at the end. And then they manage to make you love him again. What?
Oh.
What?
There you go. Well, some fantastic recommendations there. That is about it for this episode of Stab in the Dark. We've learned all sorts of things. We've learned that Danny has a problem with kind of top hats and crinoline, that kind of thing, and that once in a while, Mianna collapses surrounded by cushions. We will be back again next time, where we'll be at the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival in Harrogate to meet internationally best-selling author and creator of the Jack Reacher series, Lee Child. In the meantime, you can find out more about A Stab in the Dark at uktv.co.uk. /A Stab in the Dark, or get in touch with us on Twitter, #A Stab in the Dark. Plus, don't forget to subscribe and review us on your podcast app. I know I always say it, but your feedback really does make a difference. So if you like the show, rate and review us, say something nice, and I'll buy you a strawberry mivvy. If you say something nasty, well, you might not like where I'll be sticking that choc ice. And just a quick reminder, you can watch the very best crime drama every day on UK TV channels Alibi and Drama. So with that, it's a huge thank you to my very special guests, Danny Brocklehurst and Mianna Buring. And thanks to our producers, Paul Hirons, Joel Porter and John Lemon. My name's Mark Billingham, and thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.